Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
For much of the Florida panhandle devastated by a year-ago storm called Michael, recovery is still an elusive goal.
Still have homes that have trees going through the middle of them, crushed cars in the front yard.
Also this week, a year after Michael hit the panhandle, students are continuing to struggle with mental health issues.
When the wind starts blowing, these elementary kids particularly start crying. They want the mom or dad to come get them. They want to know if their home will be there.
We'll also learn that Florida student athletes might follow California's in being able to cash in on endorsement and other commercial deals, and we'll explore the profit potential of hemp farming. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. At least 90% of structures in Panama City, Florida, were damaged by Hurricane Michael. 1 year later, city officials are about to resume code enforcement actions. Valerie Crowder reports residential property owners say they're ready for the city to begin cracking down on neglected lots that pose a health and safety hazard to their neighborhoods.
Panama City resident Freddie Robinson owns a one-story home in the Cove neighborhood. A year after Hurricane Michael hit, Robinson's yard is free of storm debris, and he's almost finished making repairs.
You know, I just have a little bit more hardy board to put on and finish painting. And I think, as far as with my insurance, everything's up to code as far as the roof, the deck on the back. And like I said, I just have to finish the hardy board. We'll be good to go.
Many of Robinson's neighbors have fixed their homes since the storm, but a few properties on his block have remained untouched. Robinson's house is on the corner of North Palo Alto Avenue and East 3rd Street. Across the street to his right is a vacant two-story house which rises above tall grass, weeds, and overgrown bushes that almost cover the mailbox and the street gutters.
Looks like a jungle. The grass is wet up to your shoulders. I'm 6 foot. I know it's up to my shoulders. The only good thing about this over there is that FEMA put that roof on, the plastic roof, and it's lasted this whole time. It's probably better than the other roof that they had on. But it's horrible over there. They actually need to either tear it down or have them sell it.
Robinson says the home was empty for at least a decade before the storm hit. After Hurricane Michael, Panama City officials paused code enforcement actions on post-storm violations to give residents time to clean up their lots and start repairing their homes.
At some point in time, the homeowner has to fix it because there's still a lot of homes with trees on their roof. And once again, the house across the street looks like that, and there's a few vacant homes around on this road as well that needs to be addressed.
For Robinson, the neglected property across the street is mostly an eyesore. But for Pamela Yates, who lives next door, it's become a health hazard.
My cat brought in a rat, and I can't have that. You know, it just needs to be done. And it's not that we haven't called, because we have.
Yates says she's called the homeowner and code enforcement several times, but the property remains derelict.
It's gone too far. And, I'm not going to have rats in my house because she doesn't do anything, and I can't get code enforcement to do anything.
There's a number of properties that have never been touched. They look exactly like they did on the 10th of October.
City Manager Mark McQueen says code enforcement officials will begin issuing notices on October 11th. He says they'll start with owners who've neglected their properties.
They're particularly residential properties. They still have homes that have trees going through the middle of them, crushed cars in the front yard. I mean, it's just obviously an absentee owner. And so for those folks in particular, the full weight of the code enforcement process has got to be administered.
McQueen says he estimates the city will send about 2,000 notices by the end of the year.
If they choose not to do anything, it will mean that it'll go before the magistrate and the recommendation will be to demo it. It could be, you know, a couple thousand by the time it's all said and done. I hope not. But at the end of the day, what I really am hoping we're going to see out of this entire process is that the quality of life in the city of Panama City is much higher, that the economic values and the property values of our community rise.
Right now, the city only has one magistrate to decide cases related to code violations. McQueen says he plans to ask city commissioners on Tuesday to hire more magistrates to handle a larger caseload and to accelerate the process. Code enforcement actions will also resume in the unincorporated areas of Bay County after the one-year anniversary. County Manager Robert Micah says almost a third of the homes the county has identified as unsafe or unfit since the hurricane have regained compliance.
There's over, 1,000 homes on the inventory that we began with, and a little over 300 of those homes have been repaired and come into compliance. So through the course of the year, people have been making, progress, and that progress is measurable, and again, it's dependent upon each individual's, individual insurance, policy and how that relationship is going, the availability of contractors, the availability of materials, and the timeliness of which, work can get done. So we're trying to be flexible and compassionate and use common sense, when it comes to making these decisions.
Micah says he expects the county's first magistrate hearing to take place in January. Callaway and Lynn Haven have already resumed code enforcement actions. And Lynn Haven officials are sending about 100 notices per month. Magistrate hearings are also occurring monthly there. In Panama City, I'm Valerie Crowder.
Last year, after Hurricane Michael wrought havoc in the Florida Panhandle, school officials began raising concerns about an emergent mental health crisis among students. Bay County Superintendent Bill Husfeldt said in the 6 months following the storm, 50 kids had been involuntarily held for mental health treatment through the Baker Act. But Regan McCarthy reports in the first 2 months of this school year, 50 students have already been institutionally committed.
Tallahassee Democratic Senator Bill Montford represents much of the Panhandle. He's a longtime educator and says schools across the area suffered major damage during the storm.
There's not a school that was not impacted by this storm in these counties, every one of them. Jinx Junior High School, Middle School in Panama City, where I interned. It's been on national news more than one time. The gym was just blown away. And if you look at all the schools out there, what happened? And so that has a long-range impact on the students themselves, but that brings up the issue of mental health.
Montford says after Michael, even the threat of a storm is stressful for many students.
Superintendents and teachers and others are saying in many cases when the wind starts blowing, these elementary kids particularly start crying. They want the mom or dad to come get them. They want to know if their home will be there.
Donna Pilsen is the executive director of Rebuild Bay County. She says the number of homeless students in the area skyrocketed following the storm.
Before the storm, the school district, Bay District Schools, were looking at about 700 students that were categorized as homeless. After the storm, that number rose quickly to 5,000. This year so far, with the surveys that have been collected, they're looking at about 2,500 students, and that's not even hearing from all of their families.
Pilsen links that number to the number of students who are being referred for mental health treatment.
So far, there have been 202 community of care referrals. That's mental health services that's beyond what the schools can provide. There have been 50 students this year. So far, this school year so far, that have had the Baker Act applied to them. And so we're seeing a significant increase in our mental health case instances because of directly tied to the homeless situation of our students.
And officials say addressing the need for more housing has proven difficult. Christy Terry is the executive director of the North Florida Inland Long-Term Recovery Group and director of the Calhoun County Chamber of Commerce. She says thousands of people still don't have adequate housing.
When I say adequate, I mean living in homes with mold, holes in roofs with torn tarps that are barely covering the holes, living areas exposed to rain, bugs, critters, Some homes have been condemned, but with no other viable options, families remain inside, sometimes without electricity and running water.
Terry says part of the problem is that money isn't flowing to the area fast enough.
Waiting for resources to be appropriated, then months to decide how they can be used, then more months for revisions to rules, more time for implementation, then additional time to actually release the funds and try to meet the cost share is taking too long. Then it's our turn to apply and wait for funding. People cannot wait that long. Businesses can't wait that long, and communities cannot wait that long. For working parents and their children to have to literally wait 2 to 3 years to get back into their homes is unreasonable. We can do better.
Terry is pushing government officials and organizations to get available funding on the ground more quickly. And she says donations, including time and labor to rebuild homes, are still needed. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Still to come on Capitol Report, the drama ramps up in a murder case that literally spans the state, and now the spotlight of suspicion falls on the uncharged ex-brother-in-law of the victim.
They were tracing things back to him, so he was nervous and worried and just not himself.
Now there's a Florida bill to permit financial compensation for collegiate student athletes.
If that's not an unfair situation, I don't know what else is. And we simply want to correct that.
And Florida is among those states eagerly eyeing the lucrative market for growing hemp.
Do you know how to farm at this level? If you do, you will have success.
Not all of the drama in Tallahassee happens at the Capitol. For the past week, a suspected murder-for-hire case has been tried across the street at the Leon County Courthouse. At issue is the 2014 slaying of Florida State University law professor Dan Markell. On trial are two people, Sigfredo Garcia and Katie McBanua. They're charged with being part of a plot to kill Markell. But the people who have yet to be charged are the Adelson family members of South Florida. Markell's ex-wife Wendy Adelson and her brother Charlie are widely believed to be behind the killing. Blaise Ganey has been following the action.
Charlie Adelson is a South Florida periodontist who works at his family's practice, the Adelson Institute for Aesthetics and Implant Dentistry. His sister Wendy says he's had a lot of girlfriends. Thursday, one of them testified in court.
Hi, I'm June Umchinda.
Umchinda says she and Adelson dated from October 2015 to June 2017. She says they still keep in touch and spoke the night before she appeared in court. When questioned by Assistant State Attorney Georgia Kappelman, Umchinda says during the time Sigfredo Garcia and Catherine McBanua were arrested, Charlie's demeanor had changed.
When people were arrested, did you notice a change in his behavior at that time?
Yes.
Okay, tell us about that.
Well, obviously they were tracing things back to him, so he was nervous and worried and just not himself.
State prosecutors believe the Adelsons funded a murder-for-hire plot against Markell, enlisting Adelson's former girlfriend, Catherine McBanua, and her ex-boyfriend, Sigfredo Garcia. Kappelman asked Umchinda if Charlie Adelson ever kept cash on him.
Did you observe Mr. Adelson to have large amounts of cash?
Yes.
Like how much?
I don't know. I've never seen all of it, but I know he has access to it in his house.
All right. Where is it kept in his house?
It's in his bedroom in a safe.
All right. Is it like a small safe or one that's like the size of a refrigerator?
Like a refrigerator.
But how Adelson kept his cash was the important part.
And did you also say on that occasion when you were interviewed by law enforcement, so I was always like, who staples money and stuff? Like, use a paperclip or something. And then there was a question, so you've seen his money stapled together. Answer, yeah. Was that your statement?
Yes, I mentioned he had the staples on the hundreds before.
A third person, Luis Rivera, has already pled guilty in the case. He rode with Sigfredo Garcia to Tallahassee and says Garcia was the trigger man. Rivera says that's how he received his payment for his role in Markell's murder when questioned by McBanwa's attorney, Tara Kawas.
Now, you testified that when you finally did open the bag, that inside was money stacks.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. And each one was it all hundreds?
Yes, ma'am.
All hundreds. And you had mentioned that they were stapled, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Meanwhile, employees who worked for the Adelson Institute were called to testify. They say McBanwa never worked there and was only seen as a patient.
Do you know Catherine McBanwa?
Yes.
And how do you know her?
From being Charlie's girlfriend and coming to the office.
Coming to the office as a patient?
Correct.
Not coming to the office as an employee?
That is correct.
That's Erica Johnson. She worked as a dental assistant at the Adelson Institute for 8 years. During her testimony, Kawas played audio of a phone call between Johnson and Charlie Adelson that took place after law enforcement visited the business asking for proof of employment for McBanwa.
Hey, what's going on?
If you're asking for records for Katie.
For what?
That she works here?
I wouldn't get anything.
Yeah, and the ex did she work there? I was like, yeah, she works there, but I don't know what you want. So the man was sent there.
Erica.
Later in the conversation, Adelson forms a fuller sentence and tells Erica what he would do.
So I would do this. I would not speak to anybody.
He then asks where they are and hurries off the phone.
Are they there now or are they standing?
They're there, but you know, I'm in the back. They're just waiting for me to come back.
Oh, and they want records?
Yes.
Do me a favor. I'm going to call you from a landline on your cell phone, okay?
Okay.
All right, bye.
No members of the Adelson family have been charged. Sigfredo Garcia and Catherine McBanwa are currently on trial for the murder. Garcia is facing the death penalty. McBanwa is facing life in prison if they're convicted. I'm Blaze Ganey.
Following California's lead, Florida became the second state to introduce legislation pushing to allow collegiate athletes to profit from their name and likeness. Ryan Daly spoke with House Minority Leader Keon McGee, who recently filed a bill to do just that, and it's got the attention of much of the sports world.
Leader McGee, thanks again for joining me this morning to talk about your bill. And as I understand it, this bill makes Florida the second state pushing to allow collegiate athletes to profit from the use of their likeness with endorsement deals, et cetera. How does your bill work, and what changes does it make to the way the NCAA has things set up now for athletes?
All right, and thank you very much, Ron, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and your listeners. So the way it works is simply this. Currently, students enter into a contract with the university and/or the college. From there, that agreement is secured through the free market, the supply and demand, the offer and acceptance. And from there, what ends up happening is that agreement is a legitimate agreement. Everybody knows it's legally binding, it's great. The kid gets the scholarship. The university gets to have his or her talent there. What we're talking about is what happens now when the NCAA comes in with restrictions and place the restrictions upon that contract, upon the student-athlete, that prevents the student-athlete now from using his or her name for use of advertisement, for use on YouTube, on Twitter, where there's a possibility that they may gain a financial outcome because of who they are. So essentially what this bill is attempting to do, and I believe it, and it's going to do it, is simply to say we need fairness. Because when you think about it, you can have two equally situated students in the same classroom. One is in the classroom because because he's there on a athletic scholarship. Then you can have another student who's there because she's there on, let's just say, a computer science scholarship. Now, the student who's on a computer science scholarship can go out and talk about his or her name, can have a Facebook page, a YouTube page, a Twitter page, and monetize it, can allow for local individuals to tap into their expertise, although they're in college at the time, and use their image. But the same student who is in a classroom with her, who's a college athlete, cannot do either one of those things. We saw this what happened with the young man at the University of Central Florida. He was the kicker, De La Hoya. He was actually kicked off the team by the NCAA because he had a YouTube page that he monetized that had nothing to do with football. So if that is not fair, if that is not an unfair situation, I don't know what else is. And we just want to, we simply want to correct that.
And I know there was a conversation concerning the bill with Governor Ron DeSantis this week. You know, how did that conversation go, and how do you feel Governor DeSantis responded to the idea of such a bill?
Listen, the conversation with Governor DeSantis was a very productive conversation. Now, as it relates to feelings or directions on that, that's something that I'll leave with the governor, and he can answer that question. But what I will say to you, it was a very productive conversation. And at the end of the day, everyone that I've had an opportunity to speak with, they understand that there's a sense here that something needs to be done.
You know, this is a bill that's made headlines when it was filed here and in California, and it's got star power behind it, people advocating like LeBron James as a big advocate for this move. What made you interested in filing such a bill?
Fairness. We've received countless calls, you know, since I've been in the legislature. I've been receiving calls as far back as 7 years ago. And parents and students alike were complaining that it was very difficult for them to survive in college as a student athlete because of the restrictions that were placed upon them by the NCAA. Keep in mind, they were the kids, the parents, and those who want to protect those kids and parents, they wanted to lend a voice to that, to deal with the restrictions, but they didn't know how to. So we researched this years ago, and we also found out that the NCAA then, just a few years ago, had this issue on its table to deal with. And the NCAA had always said that it would review the issue and get back with us and tell us that, you know, whether or not something would change and how it would affect. So they wanted to study the issue even more. But what we're finding out now is, as it relates to that particular issue, they haven't resolved it. And so the question became from a lot of the parents. I'm in Miami-Dade County, so you know a lot of the athletes come out of Miami-Dade County that are really good at what they do. And a lot of the parents were saying, hey, what's going on? And that was mirrored by the same amount of support coming from young athletes saying the same thing. Hey, you know, I'm sitting in the classroom. I can't even accept a bag of grocery. And I'm hungry. And when I call home, my parents can't, you know, provide because they just don't have it. You know, you find out, you say, you know, that this is wrong. We're going to try this now. So when California actually did it, it was almost like you heard the sound of a train beginning to depart. And that's when we realized it's time to go. We can't wait for the NCAA to make a change to this particular rule.
And finally, I mean, anyone from the has the NCAA reached out to you at all?
Yes, there has been a conversation with the NCAA. Those conversations are going to continue. We're waiting for another call to talk about some more, some logistics, some nuts and bolts, some more research. I believe in the end, you know, the NCAA, I believe they want to do the right thing, and I believe they will do the right thing. And I think the NCAA will realize that the system that it currently has is antiquated, archaic, and there's nothing wrong with change.
That was Florida House Minority Leader Keon McGee speaking with Capitol reporter Ryan Daly. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, ever since the federal government changed its policies to allow the legal cultivation of non-psychoactive hemp, It seems nearly every state is racing to get into the hemp-growing business, and Florida is among them. In fact, it even has a newly created state government official in charge of the whole thing. She is Holly Bell, Florida's director of cannabis. A former Nashville, Tennessee consultant and banker, Bell sees one of her most important jobs as managing what are sometimes overly enthusiastic expectations when it comes to hemp.
It isn't a cure-all. It isn't an answer to everything. But done properly in the right way, it is a great diversification as an agriculture commodity.
There are plenty of states that are leaping onto the hemp-growing bandwagon, but Bell is confident there's plenty of room for everyone, at least for the immediate future.
The demand and some of the outstanding orders from large corporations to do research to add industrial hemp isolate into consumable products that cannot be filled because there's not enough quantity out there tells me that we're still a long way from hitting saturation on the demand.
Besides, Bell says industrial hemp can be used as a primary or supplemental ingredient in some 25,000 consumer product applications. That'll keep demand high. And when it comes to Florida competing in the national hemp growing arena, she believes the Sunshine State's farmers are more than up to the task.
You've got to know what you're doing to do this well. One of the reasons I believe Florida is going to do so well in this is because we have specialized farmers. They know how to grow alternative type crops, you know, drip lines with plastic down to keep the weeds out. They know how to hand tend a crop. That's what this cannabis industrial hemp crop for CBD requires initially, which is where the demand is. So that's really the key there. Do you know how to farm at this level? If you do, you will have success.
Bell thinks Florida has another advantage going for it. That's the realization that growing hemp is only part of the puzzle. Hence, this past week's big hemp summit in Tallahassee that attracted some 300 farmers, agriculture equipment sellers, economic development people, and potential manufacturers to an all-day session just a few blocks from the state capitol. Besides all the keynote addresses and panel discussions, Bell says it was the informal networking that will ultimately launch Florida's hemp industry as a viable enterprise.
There's interest out there to manufacture. There's interest out there to process. There's interest out there to grow. Getting everybody together and connected to the right people is what these conferences are about. And we saw that happen in there today. Afterwards, a mayor of a town walked up to me with a flyer for a vacant building she has. And I said, interesting, that gentleman right there just asked me about vacant buildings. Go show him your vacant building.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to Valerie Crowder. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Please join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org.